Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. South Korean Prime Minister Lee Won-kyu announced his intention to resign on April 20th over a graft scandal that continues to snowball after being accused of accepting illegal campaign funds during a parliamentary election 2 years ago. President Park Geun-hye, who has struggled to find candidates for the Prime Minister's position since she took office in 2013, is expected to make a decision on whether to accept Lee's resignation within a week. In Indonesia, the 60th anniversary Asia-Africa conference started this week, hosted by President Jokowi Widodo. The attendees for the leaders' summit include Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, with the two meeting on the sidelines of the conference for half an hour and agreeing to work on improving ties between the two countries, despite tensions over territory and history. The Philippines presidential office announced that China's Coast Guard employed water cannon on April 20th to drive away a group of Filipino fishermen at Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea, damaging some of their wooden boats and drawing a reaction from Filipino activists who denounced China's apparent act of aggression. In India, Congress Party Vice President Rahul Gandhi attacked the government's land acquisition bill in a speech to the lower house of parliament on April 20th. Gandhi has argued that Prime Minister Modi's government is ignoring farmers for the benefit of corporations. As the budget session of India's parliament resumed this week, Gandhi also told a mass rally of farmers that he was determined to derail the bill. In the US Congress, Representative Matt Salmon introduced a bipartisan bill aimed at codifying US support for allowing Taiwan to join Interpol as an observer. Currently, Taiwan relies on secondhand information and cannot share info on criminals as part of Interpol's collective database. And that's the news. Now we turn to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's milestone visit to the United States. My colleague, Cogitasia editor and podcast producer Jeffrey Bean, sat down with two longtime US-Japan hands, CSIS's Japan Chair and Senior Vice President for Asia, Dr. Michael Green, and Simon Chair in Political Economy, Matthew Goodman, to discuss the state of US-Japan relations before Prime Minister Abe's week-long visit to the United States on April 26th, and assess prospects for the finalising of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP.
So I'm joined today by Dr. Michael Green, Senior Vice President and Japan Chair at CSIS, and Matt Goodman, Senior Advisor, and William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy, to discuss the pending visit of Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who will be in Washington, D.C. next week. Thanks for joining me, guys. So I want to start with you, Mike. I want to ask, what in your view is the backdrop for this visit next week, and to what extent do you think that this demonstrates the U.S.-Japan relationship is strategically important for both countries moving forward?
Well, there are summits between the Japanese Prime Minister and the American President in Washington, you know, every 2-3 years. But this is a big one. It will be noted by historians because it's the first time a Japanese Prime Minister will address a joint session of Congress. Because the United States and Japan will issue new defense guidelines, which update our alliance to deal with new challenges like cyber space or outer space, but also position Japan to provide more support to the U.S. Beyond just the defense of the home islands. And then, as Matt will, I'm sure, explain, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the most important trade liberalizing effort in the Asia-Pacific region in history. Those are big agenda items, and it's all in the context of a U.S.-Japan alliance, which has problems like any bilateral relationship, but is backed by common values, interests, and mutual respect. In opinion polls now, Americans pretty consistently rank Japan as one of the top 3 or 4 most trustworthy countries in the world, and the Japanese support for the U.S.-Japan alliance in polls has never been higher. So it's a recognition that with a rising China, with a changing geoeconomic landscape, the U.S. and Japan, with our common interests and values, need to stand closer together and update our relationship to get things done.
Matt, I wanted to turn to you for a second as well and ask, what do you think is on the table right now for the U.S.-Japan economic and commercial relationship?
Well, on the economic side, we are on the brink, as Mike suggested, of a really historic breakthrough in our trade relationship and in trade more broadly in the Asia-Pacific region. When Mike and I started working on Japan 30 years ago, it was unimaginable that the U.S. and Japan could enter into what is effectively a free trade agreement between, you know, these two enormous economies. But now we're on the brink of that. The 12 countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership have been negotiating for about 5 years. And it feels, based on all the indications, like we're very close to an agreement among the 12. And one of the critical steps towards that is for the U.S. and Japan to agree on a bilateral deal. U.S. and Japan agree on most of the rules that are being negotiated in this agreement. We agree on things like intellectual property rights and competition and good regulatory practices and lots of other things in the basic TPP agreement. We've had long-standing disputes on market access into our two countries, but we're very close, it appears, to reaching an agreement on difficult issues like automobiles and agriculture. And it's unlikely that the two leaders, Obama and Abe, are going to actually shake hands on a deal when they meet next week, but it will be a clear indication that we're very close, and I think with just one more surge after that, I think there's a good chance that we're going to get this done this spring.
Excellent. Thank you. And I want to follow up. You know, you sort of outlined what will be discussed on the economic side. Mike, you gave an overview of the agenda and the issues on the table. What do you think Prime Minister Abe's goals are, and what are President Obama's goals as a result of this summit?
Well, they're actually very closely aligned. They both need TPP. I think for Japan, TPP is more fundamental to Japanese restructuring and long-term economic growth, whereas for the U.S., it probably has more to do with creating rules for a trans-Pacific economic agenda that keep the entire global economic system functioning well. On the defense side, Prime Minister Abe wants to revise our bilateral defense guidelines, the basic document that describes how we'll work together as two allies and what our militaries will do together. He has already declared his intention to recognize and actually use Japan's right of collective self-defense. The UN Charter gives every country in the world the right to defend themselves, individual self-defense, and collective self-defense to work with others for the common good. Now, Japan's never exercised that right, although constitutionally they have it. You know, Abe has decided and won cabinet support to do that. So the defense guidelines will mean that Japan now will be able to provide support for U.S. Forces in a crisis. That support could be logistical. It could be clearing the waters of submarines or clearing the air of ballistic missiles that are shooting at our forces. It does not mean Japan will send military forces to attack other countries. It means they'll work with us to make our operations more effective. So this is something Japan wants because it needs our alliance to be effective because North Korea is continuing to develop nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, because China's defense budget is increasing still for the second decade in a row at double-digit growth rates a year. And Japan needs more deterrence and needs more stability. And for the U.S., our defense budget is actually declining. In the Asia-Pacific region, we're trying to maintain capability, but we need more support from our allies. So it's win-win on both of those. And I think politically, both President Obama and Prime Minister Abe need to show they're good stewards of the alliance right now for their domestic politics.
Turning to domestic politics in both the U.S. and to some extent in Japan as well, Senator Hatch, we had Scott Miller on the Scholl chair a couple weeks ago, and he projected that Senator Hatch would introduce legislation. It turned out to be bipartisan legislation in the Senate Finance Committee. In your view, where does trade promotion authority or so-called fast-track authority, where does it stand now as it relates to TPP, and does the introduction of the bill give the negotiations an additional jolt or impetus moving forward?
Yes, well, this has been a very significant development, the introduction of this legislation, which people have been waiting for a very long time, and it looks like it's going to be marked up and moved even to the full Senate and ultimately the House, potentially within the next few weeks for a vote, and it looks as though, knock on wood, the vote is going to be positive. TPA is critical because it empowers, it's Congress's grant of authority and guidance, really, to the administration to go out and negotiate these trade agreements. Without that authority, the administration has to sort of negotiate blind, and without the confidence that they can project to trading partners that whatever is agreed on, whatever compromises are made in the negotiating room, will actually be approved and, you know, honored by Congress when they vote to ratify the agreement. This authority gives that certainty, and it's been missing from the negotiations really since 2007 when it last expired. And it's an absolutely critical part of the debate. And among others, Japan has been waiting for this bill to be introduced and ultimately passed. And I think in that sense, now that it is moving and the prospects look good, I mean, you never know in Washington, so nobody wants to be absolutely resting on our laurels yet. But I do think that that this is looking good. And I think it will give momentum to the negotiations, both bilaterally between the U.S. and Japan, and then ultimately among the 12 parties in TPP. So I think definitely what's happened this week has given a really positive boost to the prospects for a good TPP agreement.
Mike, you mentioned that Prime Minister Abe will be addressing a joint session of Congress. How significant is this, and what do you expect him to discuss in the context of this speech?
He's going to celebrate the accomplishments, specifically the new defense guidelines, and some nod to TPP. It won't be done, but there will be enough momentum probably that he can give that a nod and perhaps call on Congress to provide trade promotion authority when he speaks to them. He'll celebrate 70 years since the end of the war, a remarkable transformation in the U.S.-Japan relationship from brutal, almost, you know, racist enemies to two peoples on the earth who have enormous respect and affection for each other and for each other's culture and accomplishments. And look at the future. You know, what can the U.S. and Japan do together? That's going to be the main theme. I think the administration and members of Congress and other countries in Asia are going to be looking at the speech to see what he says about history, about Japan's annexation of Korea, war with China, and all the rest of the baggage that complicates Japan's relations with its neighbors. You know, it's uncertain what he'll say about that. On August 15th, the actual 70th anniversary of the end of the war, he's expected and has said that he will put out a statement on what this all meant and means. And there's a view in Japan that the U.S. Congress is not the place to do that, which is probably right. But at the same time, as much as he celebrates and we celebrate the accomplishments in the U.S.-Japan alliance, an important part of Japan's role in our alliance is to be a pillar of stability in Asia, which Japan has done with enormous success. And throughout Asia, polling about Japan is very positive. Southeast Asia, 96% of respondents in a recent poll said they trust Japan. China, for domestic political and ideological reasons and because of the reality of what happened, will be very, very hard to convince to forgive Japan. But Korea is a U.S. ally, it's a democracy, and I think that the administration and members of Congress would appreciate some gesture or some statement from the Prime Minister about the importance of relations with Korea. Because right now, Japan-Korea relations are stalled over history and other issues, which sets back American foreign policy in Asia on issues like North Korea and so forth. So what exactly he'll say, I don't know. It's not supposed to be a speech about history, but some reference, if not in the congressional speech, in other speeches he's giving in L.A. or Boston, I think would go a long way towards adding a dimension to this very strong alliance that people are looking for.
Thanks, Mike. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
That was Michael Green and Matthew Goodman. Next up is our weekly leaderboard, our profile of a key figure shaping policy in Asia. This week, we profile Wang Qishan. Wang Qishan is head of the Central Commission for Discipline and Inspection, the Chinese Communist Party's anti-corruption watchdog agency. Before joining the Politburo Standing Committee in November 2012, Wang served as vice premier under Wen Jiabao, where he was China's chief representative to the Strategic Economic Dialogue. During this period, Wang gained a reputation in the US for his able management of economic policy. When he was chosen to head the anti-corruption campaign, some China watchers considered it a waste of his talents when so many economic difficulties are still confronting China. Called the chief of the fire brigade, Wang is known for his ability to stand toe-to-toe with tough challenges. He was brought in as mayor of Beijing during the 2003 SARS crisis and was charged with leading the response to the 2008 global financial crisis. He has a reputation for being straightforward, a quality General Secretary Xi Jinping has found valuable in a Communist Party system that can breed obsequious behavior and groupthink. In mid-March 2015, Wang announced his intention to travel to the United States to hammer out details on a possible but unlikely extradition treaty with American officials, as well as avenues for further cooperation and information sharing on corrupt officials. In preparation, he submitted a list of over 1,000 officials who have fled to the United States since the 2012 18th Party Congress. This is part of a larger crackdown Wang is leading called Operation Skynet, aimed at rounding up officials and assets that have fled China. This trip is an important escalation in the campaign with a clear message: corrupt officials are not safe anywhere. It reflects Wang's new focus on targeting tigers, or senior officials, versus flies, or lower officials, and the factions surrounding them. In 2013 and 2014, the anti-corruption drive was akin to using a sledgehammer to beat corruption. This year, Wang is trading in the sledge for a scalpel. Whether the United States will cooperate with Wang in a campaign viewed as extremely controversial outside China remains to be seen. He technically has 2 years left and must retire at the 19th Party Congress in November 2017 due to informal age rules. However, his efforts may have made him so invaluable that Xi is considering bending the rules to let Wang stay on. Expanding the anti-corruption drive overseas will mark the latest achievement in Wang Qishan's legacy of taking on challenges for China's Communist Party. Expect him to aim for targets that are commensurate with his career. Now we turn to America's security engagement in the Asia-Pacific. In a time of limited fiscal resources, the United States is still the primary provider of security in Asia. The United States is increasingly seeking new ways to enhance its connections with partners and allies to sustain stability and prosperity in the region. My colleague, Japan Chair Fellow Zach Cooper, caught up with Senior Vice President and Kissinger Chair Dr. Kathleen Hicks and our Japan Chair Michael Green to discuss how their approach of federated defense in Asia would be helpful to U.S. security partners in countering coercive behavior and overcoming regional challenges.
I'm Zach Cooper, and I'm here today with the co-directors of a recent CSIS project entitled Federated Defense in Asia. Dr. Michael Green is the Senior Vice President for Asia and Japan Chair at CSIS. And Dr. Kathleen Hicks is CSIS's Senior Vice President, Kissinger Chair, and Director of the International Security Program. Thank you both for being with us. First, Dr. Hicks, can I ask you to describe federated defense and why you think it's so important today?
Sure. Federated defense is our way of talking about the range of missions and efforts underway to build capacity among partners in the world. Our concept for federated defense is that the world is getting much more complex, the challenges are overwhelming for any individual nation, to include the United States, and frankly, resources for defense are getting tighter and tighter. And in that kind of environment, it's particularly important to find ways to build capacity and strengthen any initiatives where the U.S. and its allies and partners can support each other in collective defense endeavors. So that's the concept we have for federated defense, and it begins at the most basic levels of information sharing and can grow to the most complex of systems like anti-access area denial. But it all has to be built on trust and interoperability.
And Dr. Green, why is federated defense so important in Asia at this time?
Well, because it's long overdue. In Europe, our command structure incorporates all our NATO allies. But in the Asia-Pacific region, we have a overlapping and somewhat divided command structure. We have the Pacific Command, which covers the entire region, U.S. Forces Japan, U.S. Forces Korea. And as a result, our capacity building exercises and planning is very disjointed. We have a very high-end relationship with Japan and Korea, focusing on fifth-generation fighters and the most advanced capabilities. And then we have allies and partners like the Philippines, New Zealand, and so forth, with whom we do sort of specialized areas. And then we have countries that need the most fundamental kind of capacity to deal with natural disasters or piracy. And it's been difficult, frankly, for the Pacific Command or the Department of Defense to take a holistic view of the whole region. We need to do it because starting at the lower end of the technology spectrum, This is a region that has a major calamitous natural disaster with some predictability every 2 or 3 years. And these disasters can really set back a country like the Philippines or an island like Palau. And in addition to the humanitarian and human aspect, strategically, it is a problem because when countries are on their back foot, when they're less resilient, then they're more prone to external coercion and pressure, and it invites competition that's unhealthy. And then moving up the spectrum to higher end allies, we are developing fifth generation fighters, missile defense capabilities, intelligence systems, space, cyber, and other systems that are extremely expensive and complex, and you can't do bilaterally. We need to share the expense, share the resources, share the expertise. So we need to move from what had been the classic hub and spokes approach to Asia, where the US was the hub and through our bilateral alliances we had spokes that held together security, to something closer to what we're calling in this report hubs and spokes, where our allies and partners like Japan or Australia or Korea can help other countries with capacity building. And it won't be one size fits all, it'll have to be eclectic, but we're going to have a strategic concept and approach in Washington and in Hawaii.
And one of the things that you mentioned was humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. I wonder if you can provide some more details about how the United States can assist in these kinds of situations and how Federated Defense can play in. Dr. Hicks?
Sure, I'll start on that. This is a global issue, but Asia in particular, particularly Southeast Asia and the Indian Ocean are areas where we can really see the potential for partnering more effectively through a federated approach. As I mentioned earlier, in many ways, the simplest place you start is one of the most important for humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, and that's information sharing. There's so many layers of different intelligence availability and intelligence sharing arrangements, but even on open source information, there's a great deal more that can be shared. The United States and its partners in the region have some of that architecture in place. Through Thailand and also through Singapore. There are some facilities that we can use and some facilities that help us to exchange information. And this is a place where, as Mike said, we know every several years there's a disaster. We know all the countries in the region, to include China, share an interest in making sure they're better prepared for those disasters and better able to respond. So it's a great place to start building that trust and interoperability that are so important for federated defense.
One of the more high-end capabilities that is often discussed in a federated context is the Australian Collins-class replacement. And I wonder, Dr. Green, if I could ask you a little bit about some of the advantages of cooperation on the Collins-class replacement, which Japan is often mentioned in, but also some of the hurdles that will have to be overcome.
Well, the Royal Australian Navy has a requirement to replace its Collins-class submarines, which are mostly indigenous, but the weapon suite and key technologies and systems integration was provided with the U.S. expertise. And when the Australian government looked around for the best long-range diesel submarine, they discovered that it was, in fact, Japan that was at the cutting edge, and approached the Japanese and approached us about an effort to help Australia develop its new submarine in some joint way with the Japanese and with perhaps a U.S. role helping as well. It has the strong support of Prime Minister Abe in Tokyo and Prime Minister Abbott in Canberra, who see this as a way not only to pool resources and have more capability, but to put some real meat on the bone of a strategic relationship, namely between Japan and Australia, that both leaders are keen to bring to the next level. And so it has strategic merit, it has technological merit, it has operational merit. The challenges are that when you collaborate, you have to share. You have to share work, you have to share technology, you have to share budgets, and there are always interests domestically that get anxious about that. And within Australia, labor unions are worried that they'll lose jobs. I think they're wrong. In fact, they currently have no jobs because they're not making submarines. But they worry that, you know, work share will go to Japan. And then on the Japanese side, there's concern that maybe they'll give away technology that's sensitive. That is the oldest story in the book when it comes to defense industrial collaboration. We've had that with the British, we've had it with the Australians, the closest allies in the world have that. American companies have that with each other and with the Department of Defense. So I think the Japanese and Australian governments will overcome those hurdles. They'll build an excellent diesel sub, and it will enhance their bilateral relations and enhance the security that we, the U.S., Japan, other maritime powers enjoy in the undersea domain, where we're dominant and are likely to be in a strong position in the future if we continue this kind of collaboration.
One of the different domains which the U.S. is maybe less dominant in is in the South China Sea, where we've recently seen a substantial island building by the Chinese. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how federated defense applies in a South China Sea context, and whether you think it can help the region to link together more to respond to what is seen as Chinese coercion.
So the Chinese have been reclaiming land and building runways and ports in over a half a dozen atolls across the South China Sea. It's legal. Other countries like Vietnam have done it, but not on the scale and not with the speed that China has, and not with this strong coercive element represented by China's enormous military budget and maritime services. We can't stop China under international law, and we're certainly not going to fight a war over this, but it really highlights how important it is for countries like the Philippines, for example, to have the capacity to know what's going on in their own maritime domain and have some basic equipment and systems to patrol it and demonstrate their administrative control. And the Philippines don't have that right now. They have very poor maritime domain awareness. The archipelago is enormous. It's full of straits and waterways that the Philippines' very, very small navy can't possibly patrol. So one area where federated defense could help would be to give them the kind of surveillance and overall domain awareness at sea that is not terribly expensive that countries like the U.S. or Japan or Australia could help provide. And the other would be for some surface vessels, patrol craft, Coast Guard-like vessels to show the flag, to patrol, to demonstrate that this is not a vacuum. This points to another dimension of federated defense, though, because we could provide equipment for surveillance, and we could provide patrol craft. We've given two old Coast Guard cutters, Japan's promised eight. But organizationally, the Philippine Navy and the Armed Forces of the Philippines have a lot of work to do. And so another aspect of federated defense is that, is training, exercises, doctrine, helping organize and retain the force. There's a lot to this other than just equipment and technology that a country like the Philippines needs to avoid becoming a kind of a vacuum that will draw in big power competition.
One other area that is very much related to what China has been doing has been the Hill's response. And recently, the Capitol Hill has become more and more interested in Chinese activities in the South China Sea. And I wonder whether you can talk a bit about how the Capitol Hill is actually important to federated defense, to federated approaches, and what their role is in encouraging these kinds of efforts.
Well, I'll start to answer that. I think that what Congress has really indicated, I think, in their most recent series of legislative actions and hearings is, as you say, this strong concern with what China is attempting to do, which, as Mike relayed, has this giant coercive power behind it, which really changes the tone and tenor of what a country is doing when it's building out these land areas. What I think is helpful in the U.S. context is to demonstrate to a country like China that's undertaking such activity that for the United States, there's a bipartisan unified concern here that won't change over time, just as U.S.-China policy has ebbed and flowed a bit but remained essentially the same over the last 30 years in terms of how we view China. It will be true going forward that there will be Democrats and Republicans, executive branch and Congress, who will be looking at China with concern as it builds out capabilities and builds up land in this way.
So often in the debate about how to respond to Chinese coercion against countries like the Philippines or the Vietnam or even Japan over, rocky atolls, people will argue we don't want to fight a war over a bunch of rocks. And the whole point is to avoid fighting a war over a bunch of rocks. And that's why we need to help countries like the Philippines have the capacity to demonstrate presence and to complicate the planning of larger powers like China that would use coercion to change the facts on the ground, to change the status quo, to try to take control of this enormous waterway that lies between the first island chain and the coast of China and Vietnam. And at the end of the day, the reality is that the U.S. Has been willing to fight to protect the first island chain. We did it in 1941. We doubled down when the Soviets built up and tried to intimidate the first island chain in the Cold War. We are not, as a strategic matter, going to let Japan or any other major democracy fall under the sway of a hostile power. Fortunately, we're not there yet. We're not talking about that kind of scenario right now. But the way to avoid ever having to get to that scenario is to make sure that in cases like the Philippines or Vietnam or Indonesia, there's a cost, frankly, to China for using these coercive tactics. And the cost comes from transparency, which is why maritime domain awareness is important, demonstrating to the world what's happening. The cost would also be imposed in terms of these countries having the capability to show the flag, to patrol their waters, to know what's going on, and in terms of the collective efforts of countries in the region. There won't be a NATO or a collective security organization of that kind in Asia in almost any scenario. But Beijing will think twice if it sees that its activities are causing more cooperation among the countries that are all facing similar coercion. So we can't stop the Chinese from this current land reclamation. We can't reverse it directly, but indirectly we can put up brakes that make it harder for China to turn what Beijing calls the near sea, these waters that stretch from the Sea of Japan down to the South China Sea, into a Chinese lake where the Chinese would use coercion and ultimately have some control over and denial over sea lanes that see over half of world container traffic pass through.
Are there changes that the U.S. government needs to make to implement federated defense?
There certainly are. The United States really has many barriers that it puts up to a more federated approach, not least of which are the cultural barriers. That is to say, even where we have the right authorities, we have the right intentions, our tendency is to think America first in terms of the way in which we build capabilities, in which we develop programs. And we need to really change that mindset and understand that there's a global supply chain out there for defense today, just like there is for your iPhone or for any other device that Americans are used to using. So as we think about defense in the future, the question isn't, is it built in America? The question is, where is the most innovative technology and capability? Who has it, and how do we make sure we share it with those who need it, whether it's here in the U.S. or our important allies abroad?
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you very much for joining us today.
That was Dr. Kathleen Hicks and Dr. Michael Green. And now on to our one to watch. While Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is due to arrive in the U.S. next week, it's remarkable to remember that Japan is only a little over 4 years removed from the March 11, 2011 earthquake and tsunami disaster. The tragedy killed nearly 20,000 Japanese and caused nuclear accidents at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The struggle to clean up from the disaster continues. The operator in charge of decommissioning Fukushima, TEPCO, recently postponed plans to build an underground ice wall to prevent groundwater from flowing into the radioactive complex. The reactor meltdown in the plant contaminated roughly 300 tons of groundwater each day and has saturated the soil with radiation. A new plan to remove radioactivity from the water and then discharge the cleaned water into the Pacific has also been opposed by local fishermen. Overall, one estimate projects it could take 40 years to complete the cleanup effort. Meanwhile, the Japanese government has begun a long-term plan to build $6.8 billion worth of protective seawalls along the country's coast to shield it from future tsunamis. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.